WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlantis Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Well, good morning and welcome to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning. We are live here for the next 2 hours. Your host, Wes Moss, here. Take your calls and your questions. Forget the 4% rule. Rethinking common retirement beliefs. Another ridiculous article in the Wall Street Journal that we need to break down. Another disinformation type article that will confuse the heck out of all investors. I had a couple of friends and clients and colleagues email me an article that was recently published in the Wall Street Journal that gets to the very number that keeps us all up at night. Is there anything more important than this number? Not, it's not your nest egg number. It's not your spending number. It's not your mortgage amount to pay your mortgage off. It is the following number that will be the topic of discussion today here on Money Matters, and is the topic of discussion in retirement planning circles and has been for years, arguably because it's one of the most or the most important number to focus in on. And that is the withdrawal rate number that you use in your retirement planning. How much can you take out? How much can you take out of the nest egg over time and not run out of money? That is what we're all worried about. That's why we're climbing, saving to a point. And it all is predicated upon how much of it per year we can use. How much can you withdraw every year? Can you take 4%? Can you take 5%? How about 6%? I don't know, 7. What's the number? Is it 4%? With inflation every year? Is it 4% without inflation? Is it 4.1 or 4.2? I think I've heard something like the 4.1, right? Is it 5% without inflation? $1,000 a month rule. I've written about it many a time. Or is it some sort of combination strategically of all those numbers put together? There's an article this week in the Wall Street Journal that I want to break down. Here's the title. Forget the 4% rule. Can't even take 4% anymore. Rethinking common retirement beliefs. Typical headline in the personal finance section. So it says you can't use the 4% rule anymore. What? Instead, they want you to use the 3% rule. You know, as you go through this, and again, there's so much wrong about this article. It says today the new rule is 3%. And as I read through this, it's this typical drumbeat of you really can't do anything in retirement kind of numbers we've talked about over the last year. Hey, better yet, don't use 3. So 4%'s dead. Can only use 3. Hey, better yet, only just use 2% of your money. Even better, take 0% every year of your money, and that way you won't run out. And oh, by the way, remember Susie Orman? We talked about this a couple months ago. Susie Orman wants you to work until you're at least 70. This professor, Wade Fu, P-F-A-U, Wade Fu, professor at the American College of Financial Services in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, says that the 3% rule is the new safe withdrawal rule, or rate. So you put the Susie together. Let's say you had Susie and Fu do your retirement planning for you. You know what they'd say? They'd say, listen, you got to work until you die. Take out nothing ever. And then you'll never run out of money while you're living. That's really what this all gets to. And I have a huge problem with all of this crap advice for a lot of different reasons. So one, first of all, the study and the assumptions that they use in this latest article, way off base from reality, at least from what I can tell. And at some point, the advice or advice in general when it comes to financial planning and investment advice, particularly financial planning, and this is more of a planning number here. Hey, how much can I withdraw every year? At some point, advice has to work in the real world for real people. It's got to be applicable to most people in order for it to be advice or a rule. Otherwise, it's universally useless. Rather than basing someone's entire retirement career on platitudes that can never fail, okay, hey, work till you die, take out virtually 0%, and that way you can't run out of money. That doesn't help anybody. That's advice. That doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help support the average person in America. And it leads to people, and this is why it makes me so angry, it just leads to people giving up and never getting started to begin with. And that is a real problem in America. Most people have just give up way before they even start. Well, man, I got to save. We had a call last week. Hey, Wes, I just read an article that I need to save 25 times my salary to get to retirement. So I make 100 grand, I have to have at least 2.5 million, right? If I'm making 200 grand a year, I have to have $5 million in order to get to retirement. How many people do that? Not a lot of people. And then, so you gotta save 25, 30X your salary, then you gotta work till you're 70, and then never use any more than 3%. That's pretty discouraging, if you ask me. So no wonder most people quit before they start. So today I wanted to get into some real world advice. I want to talk about the reality of putting together what I've seen over 20 plus years when it comes to how much money do you use? And it's a slightly mundane, boring topic, but it's not at all, because it's something that I know you're thinking about this. One of the most common conversations I have with any family, and it doesn't matter if they have $500,000 or $5 million, you're worried about the same thing. How much every single year can I use? What's the percentage amount every year that I can use pretty much on average so that I know that I won't run out of money by the time I'm 95 or 100? And, oh, by the way, I'd like to leave some money to my kids at some point. Some people want to do that. Some families don't. Funny, Luke Moss in the studio just perked up when I said that through his blue glasses that make him kind of look smart and cute. He just paid attention for the first time all morning when I said something about leaving money to your heirs. Luke, that's pretty smart of you. Pretty smart of you. Just gave me a little thumbs up. Okay. So that's what we're talking about today. I went back and read the 4% rule study from the great William Bengen, financial planner. He had a bachelor's of science degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Yes, that's MIT, in aeronautical engineering. And he became a financial advisor. That's pretty good advertisement. Pretty smart guy, right? And he is the grandfather of what you and I have come to know, the 4% rule. I went back and read the study, the original study, black and white. His original work on trying to understand how much you can pull out safely without running out of money. And that original study is the genesis of, hey, 4%, that's the number that you can take out. And he published this in the Journal of Financial Planning back in 1994. And that has become, his study has become the standard in the personal finance investment planning industry. 4% rule. That he is the father of the 4% rule. Somewhat of a, it's a universally agreed upon standard in investment planning. And it boils down to this. I'm going to sum up the rule. It's not just the 4% rule. There's a little bit to it. So here's what you need to remember about this rule. You can take, Bengen says, and the study plays out and proves out to some extent, that you can take, or you should be able to take, 4% of your initial investment from your retirement assets plus inflation. All right, so 4%, and it's actually from your initial amount, plus taking that specific dollar amount and ratcheting up for inflation every single year. And if you do that, as long as you have at least, here's the second part of it, at least 50% in equities. And by the way, he runs this in several different iterations. So it's between 50% and 75% invested in stocks. over the course of your retirement career, you don't run out of money. Or you, or the money lasts at least 35 years in the worst case scenario. If you retire in the worst possible year to retire because of timing in investment markets. And oh, by the way, that amount gets rebalanced. So you don't just leave it and let it let your portfolio or your allocation mix become modified or morphed over all 20, 30 years. You rebalance it. If you start with 50% in equities, you rebalance it back to 50% equities every single year. So if you start with 4%, then you ratchet that same amount up every year. So then the worst case scenario, your money lasts 35 years. In most instances, your money will actually last 50 years plus in this data. In many cases, you're actually left with much more at the end of the line than when you started. In fact, if you go back and you look at the 50 different starting points that he uses, 40 out of the 50 different starting points, so let's call that 80% of the time, retirement assets lasted 50 plus years. And he stops the study at 50 because most folks don't have more than 50 years in retirement. So if you start with $1 million in year one, you take 4% of that number, that's $40,000. Then inflation jumps that same first year by 5%. So in year two, you take $40,000 plus 5%. So your new base is 42 grand. Then the next year, inflation jumps 10% as an example. Your new baseline is 46,200. So there's a giant inflation component in his study. There's a lot more to talk about with this very topic here on Money Matters. And if you miss Money Matters or miss some of this, of course, you can find us on the podcast. Go to iTunes and look up Wes Moss Money Matters or Money Matters Wes Moss, and you'll find the podcast version of the show. And by the way, if you're a regular podcast listener, highly appreciated, please leave a review on iTunes or wherever you hear it, or YouTube or wherever it is. I highly appreciate that as well. The number in the studio, by the way, and there's a lot to talk about. So the number here in the studio, 404-872-0750. Your questions about withdrawal rate, a mutual fund, an ETF, how you're invested, how you're balanced, what your pension might look like. Hey, Wes, I'm about to buy an annuity, about not to buy a new. What should I be doing? My wife and I are confused. We've been talking about it all week. Hey, maybe we should give Wes a call on Sunday morning, Money Manager. Well, sure, do that. That's why we're here. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. More Money Matters straight ahead.
Now back to Wes Moss and the money and investing advice you need.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. As we talk through arguably the most important variable, if you're doing some math, you do it, whether you do it on a piece of paper, you do it on your own Excel spreadsheet, or you're using a fancy retirement planning calculator that takes into account every variable under the sun, arguably the most important lever is the amount you take out from a percentage standpoint from whatever your nest egg is. So whether it's 250,000 or 10 million, 5 million, doesn't matter. It's the percentage that you use every year that is, of course, always been in question. So the 4% rule was originally established back in, well, really it was published in 1994 by an MIT graduate, William Bengen, and he ran an iteration of retiring in any given year throughout history. So, of course, the scenarios that obviously did not work well were the ones where you retired, let's say, right before the Great Depression hit and the stock market ended up down 50, 60, 70%. That was a tough time to retire. And if you think about this, that's the fear that we all, to some extent, it's a legitimate worry that we all have. What if I retire? I've got this investment portfolio, and then the next 5 years, the first 5 years of my retirement, we end up with a terrible market. Stock market bad, bond market bad, inflation bad, you name it, all the variables work against you. That's the worry that we have. So you've got to take this, all of these scenarios into account to try to determine a good starting point, a good rule of thumb. So again, the rule boiled down to you can take 4% of your initial investment plus inflation every year, as long as you have at least 50% in equities and rebalance every year. And in the worst case scenario under Bengen's historical work, you ended up money lasting 50 years in most cases, 80% of the time, and in the worst scenarios or worst timing, 35 years plus or minus. So that's what we want to talk through today here on Money Matters. And of course, I want to take your call. So phone lines open this morning. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750. Whether it's a pension question, whether it's, hey, I'm about to buy an annuity, I've got thought about college for my kids, my wife and I are thinking about retiring, or my husband's thinking about calling it quits early from work, maybe working part-time, we're in the retirement gray zone. Let's talk that through here on a Sunday morning. It's the fun part of Money Matters. The number in the studio, 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. More Money Matters straight ahead. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here, WSB Radio. Wes Moss here every Sunday morning talking about arguably the most important variable when it comes to planning. And there's a lot of important variables, of course. What are you going to spend? How much are you saving? What your nest egg looks like? What kind of inflation rate you model, how much your rate of return is, of course, over time, how much you're saving every year. Do you ratchet that savings up or not? But arguably, the most important lever in that calculation has to do with how much are you using in any given year over time. Is it 3%, 4%, 5% with inflation, without inflation? And that's the art. That is what we're trying to break down here today. And there's a lot left to do that because it impacts all of you, all of us. How much can we use? And what got me fired up about this, here we go through, we've had a wonderful run in equity markets. Then we had our first big correction or sizable wake-up correction over the last several weeks. Markets did better this past week and put some of that behind us. But there's so much to think about when it comes to planning and investing. And that's what we do here on Sunday mornings. That's the fun part about what we do here on the show. And we like to think that we are arguably the most objective, last bastion for objective financial advice left on the radio in America. And we're going to continue to do that as long as we possibly can. So the number in the studio, 404-872-0750. Phone lines open, ready to take your calls and answer anything you want to throw at us here on a Sunday morning to give you our best advice or just a best direction. We're not going to solve all the world's problems today, but we're going to hopefully give you something important to think about. Again, 404-872-0750 or 1-800-WSB-TALK. We're going to go to the phones right now. We're going to start with, let's see here. We're going to start with Luis, who joins us on the line from Marietta. Good morning, Luis. What's going on? How can I help, man?
Good morning, Wes. It's just a very straightforward question. You are even talking about allocation of 50% stocks in order to last your retirement time. But what I have noticed in the recent downturn market is that both stocks and bonds have gone down. So where is that common wisdom that says that when stocks go down, bonds go up and vice versa? I mean, doesn't seem to be working right now.
Well, I think that is a really important and good, it's an important observation, and you're exactly right. There are several days, if you go back and look at the market calamity that we have just kind of lived through, and it's not unlike, there are plenty of times when this has happened, where you see this big downdraft in stocks, and on a good day, when diversification is working, Luis, what do you see? You see your bonds go up, and you look at your portfolio, and you say, wow, that correction on the stock side was rough, but it was sure nice that the value of my bonds actually went up a little bit. And it really acts as the buffer that you're looking for over time. Over the past correction, the opposite happened. Stocks went down and bonds went down. Well, the reason that happened this time, and again, we're talking about these short-term periods of time. Literally, this is a series of days, is that the bond environment was very different in this latest correction on the stock side than it has been in the past. And that is because we are in an extraordinarily high growth environment for the economy. We're in a high growth period of time for earnings. So unlike most of the corrections we've had in the last decade or so, stocks correct typically, Luis, typically because we're worried about the economy hitting the brakes, slowing down dramatically, hurting earnings, all of a sudden we're in bad shape, right? When we do that, We're not worried about inflation typically. We're worried about things slowing down. And money runs to the bond market, and bonds become this wonderful safe haven for money. The correction that we just lived through, Luis, was relatively unique in the fact that the worry here was that the economy was too good, right? So we've got all these good economic numbers, the unemployment's low, going lower, wages going up and headed higher. And that means that we have some inflation and arguably interest rates headed higher for the short term as they get back to more normal levels. And when that happens and rates go back up, bond prices go down. So we saw that happening all in the same days. Well, that doesn't typically last forever. So remember that even though we might get some, you don't get diversification every single time stocks and bonds move, right? Some days they move together. But most of the time, let's call it the majority of the time, over time, they have a either flat correlation or a slightly negative correlation. If you go back and look at some of the most difficult periods of time for stocks, you look at the correction in 2007 that started in 2008, you look at 2000, 2001, 2002, those are really good periods of time to look at and say, okay, stocks got hit pretty badly. Well, bonds actually did really well. So diversified portfolio did well during those years where stocks did poorly, bonds held their value, and in some of those cases actually went up tremendously. It didn't happen in the 2-week correction that we had, but it doesn't mean the correlation that the help that you get stocks and bonds being somewhat inversely correlated doesn't mean that relationship is dead or gone. And I think, Luis, what you'll see is that once interest rates get back to a more normal historic level, so a historical level, and we're getting closer and closer to that. Remember, a year ago, the 10-year treasury was at 2.1% yield. That's tremendously low over the course of history. We closed out this past week knocking on the door of 3%. So rates have come up tremendously, and we might very well continue higher for a little while here. We might go to 3.5% on the 10-year treasury yield. And during that rise, bond prices aren't going to look, they're not going to do wonderfully well. They're not going to do great. But once you get back to a more, quote, normal level, you'll start to see that inverse correlation come back between stocks and bonds. So just because it didn't work over the course of a few days doesn't mean that diversification that we get between the two asset classes, arguably the most important correlation, stocks versus bonds over time in a diversified or asset allocated portfolio, doesn't mean that relationship is gone forever. 404-872-0750 in the studio. We're going to continue on the phones here. Let's go to Chris, who joins us from McDonough. Chris, good morning. Welcome to the show. How can I help? Oh, looks like we lost Chris. Oh, no, we didn't lose him. Hang on one sec here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, here we go. We're back. Chris, okay. From McDonough, what's going on? How can I help?
Yeah, so I had a question about the TRS, the Teachers Retirement System in Georgia.
Got it.
And I've been in it for 20 years now, and we just got an email a few weeks ago telling us that the state's going to be adding a little more to it. In other words, they got to put in almost 20%, where we have to put in 6% of our salary.
Okay, and so you're doing so, Chris, you're a teacher, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and so the your contribution has gone. And I remember for a lot of years that was 5%, and you are now up to 6. Yeah, that's right. Okay, I'm actually pulling this up right now. So your employee amount has gone up to 6%. Okay.
The contribution that we contributed, yes, is 6%. It was 5% when I started 20 years ago. But my question is, the state adds their percentage. And when I started 20 years ago, it was only 9%, and then it went up to 12% that the state was contributing. Now they're going up to almost 20%, and it makes me feel a little concerned that, you know, by them having to add more money to this fund, is it, you know, is there a problem with not enough money there? I mean, because
Yeah. Okay. So this is wonderful. This is wonderful. Important point you bring up here. So if you're a teacher, listen up to this question from Chris from McDonough. If you're within the teachers' retirement system of Georgia, and I've worked with so many teachers over so many years, TRS, it's really, again, there's not a lot of programs in the working world left that have good pensions or good monthly pension amounts. And the TRS, Teacher Retirement System of Georgia, is one of the few out there that are still, I would say, healthy and significant when it comes to retirement income for perpetuity. Once you retire, you get your 20 years in, arguably 30 is better, even, of course, like any pension. The longer you work, the more you'll get from a pension standpoint. TRS is one of the good ones. Now, if you go back and look at the course of history, Chris, TRS, the contribution rates that they have to make to keep the system or keep the fund itself, or if you will, funded appropriately so that they can make sure that you get paid forever with everyone's life expectancy and actuarial tables all calculated, they've got it. They every year, very often, they change the amount that they've got to put in. So for many years, it was 5% that you had to contribute. If you go back to 2013, they upped it to 6%. So that's how much the employees, i.e. teachers, have to put in every single year. The employer rate of contribution has changed. Not every single year, Chris, but very often. So you go back to the late 90s, it was at about 12%. Around 2005, it went down to around 9%. Go back a few years, in 2016, it was about 14%. And now in 2017, they've had to ratchet. Back in 2017, they ratcheted up to about 14. Now it's about 16.8. And next year, it's anticipated to be around 20, 21%. And that's good news, Chris. They are keeping the plan funded so that, and there's obviously a lot of calculations that go into this, and we can't break them down all, and I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on exactly every variable that they're using. But if you think about it, they're investing, they own a certain assets, whether those assets do well or not. The life expectancy changes over time, actuarial tables change, the number of people in the system changes. So they've got to always adjust their calculations to keep it solvent, to keep it healthy. And that's exactly what they're doing, Chris. So I think it's a good sign. They're upping what they're contributing to your plan, to teachers' retirement system. Arguably, that's good news, just to make sure it stays funded. So I think it's a good sign for teachers all over the state of Georgia, and thank you for the call and bringing that up. 404-872-0750, the number here in the studio. If you're in Michigan, Texas, California, Pennsylvania, 1-800-WSB-TALK. You're listening to Money Matters. I'm your host, Wes Moss, right here, News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. Good morning. Welcome to the show. How can I help?
Good morning. I'm essentially calling as a follow-up question on your discussion about stocks and bonds and their inverse relationship. I guess, you know, between the bonds kind of rising over the last decade, along with stocks not as high, I'm envisioning that maybe we might not return to sort of the inverse relationship we historically have seen, primarily because inflation also might be playing a big role in that. I was just wondering if you wouldn't mind commenting on it, and maybe what other safety options would investors have to put their money in during this time?
Here, Elvin, I think that this is something that struck me in the last couple of weeks when it comes to bond investing. We talked about in an earlier caller kind of the normalization of getting back from ridiculously low rates because of quantitative easing, the Federal Reserve making sure rates stay low, artificially low. And we had a 10-year Treasury yield that historically is in the 4% range, right? Over time, 4, 4.25, 4.5. Got down to 1.5 or even lower for a shorter periods of time. So we have this pressure that has kept rates lower. What we're seeing this year is rates are headed higher and they're getting back to more normal levels. We're getting close to 3% now in the 10-year Treasury. Something important to note, if you go back about a year, the 10-year Treasury bond, so in order to get, so government 10-year government bond yielded 2.1%. That's how much you would get on every year for 10 years. Today, the 2-year government bond yields the same as it did the 10-year. So now to get 2.1%, you can get a short-term 2-year treasury. And the 10-year is now approaching 3%. So what I think is happening here, Elvin, is that we're getting back to more normal rates. As that happens and rates go back up, it's a tough period of time for bond investors. As rates go back up, you know, the inverse relationship between prices and yields, yields go back up, prices come down. But once we get back to a more normal level, 3, 3.5, 4%, which are not that far away from, bond investing becomes similar to how it's been over time. And that correlation, or that inverse correlation, so that bonds save you while stocks correct, that relationship, the reason we hold these safe assets, that comes back when rates normalize and we're getting closer and closer to that period of time. We're going to continue to talk about this highly important subject. Elvin, thank you for your call. 10 o'clock hour, we're talking about your withdrawal rate. How much can you pull from your portfolio over time as an investor or retiree? So stay tuned. Money Matters, straight ahead, News 95.5, AM 750, WSB.